I've been interested in my family's history for a long time. One of my treasured possessions is a family genealogy that someone in the family did a number of years back. I love the fact that we're able to trace the family's history back to that first person who came to these shores from England. And I'm not alone in this regard. There are lots of people out there who also enjoy doing their family histories. Genealogy, which by some estimates is America's second most popular hobby, second only to gardening, has become a big business, worth at least $1.5 billion. Once the exclusive province of spinster aunts and confirmed old bachelors, now everybody is getting in on the genealogy game, with some 2 million paid subscribers to the website Ancestry.com. Now you might ask, why the change? Why is everybody suddenly getting interested in genealogy? Because it used to be the case that you'd probably only do your family history to discover if you were related to someone rich or royal or famous. Because if you could claim to be related to, say, I don't know, Benjamin Franklin or Jesse James, then you were someone pretty interesting. Today, by and large, people are interested in genealogy because they want to find out simply where they're from. And how you do that, how you find out where you're from, has changed just as dramatically as the number of people interested in doing it. Whereas once you had to travel great distances back to where your family came from and pore over dusty piles of census lists and court records and baptismal registries, today you can do a lot of that research online. More and more census data is being digitized and made available over the internet. And websites like Ancestry.com or churches like the Mormon Church will do a lot of the work for you. You can even these days take a simple DNA test to figure out to whom you are related genetically. My colleague, Reverend Terry Jones, did this recently and found out that he was exactly 4.7% Neanderthal. I don't know how that informs your opinion of Terry and his ministry, but that's who Terry is. And knowing that, I suppose if you go back far enough, you discover that in fact we're all related one way or another. That's true of our genetic families, and it's also true of our religious families. As United Methodists, of course, we are first and foremost Christians, and that places us in a family, a wider family, known as the Abrahamic faiths, alongside our older sibling Judaism and our younger sibling Islam. Now, like in all families, the siblings haven't always gotten along very well with each other. Christianity emerged out of and soon came to be at odds with Judaism shortly after the ascension of Jesus and the beginning of the apostolic mission. Church and synagogue, though distinctly related, found themselves at odds with each other. Islam arose in the 6th century AD in part as a critique of Christianity. And both the church and purportedly Christian nations have oppressed both Jews and Muslims at various times and in diverse countries, perhaps most notoriously oppressing Muslims in the Crusades of the Middle Ages and Jews in the Holocaust of the 20th century. But my goal in the time we have left is not to assign blame, nor is it to seek to provide a detailed analysis of why related faiths have competed with each other rather than cooperating with each other. My rather more modest goal is to take a story of two brothers who found themselves in conflict and ask how we may live together as the family of God. The two brothers are Isaac and Ishmael, the sons of Abraham. Abraham, as you may recall, is a great hero of the Bible because he went when God said, "Go." And he went without doing a credit check, without doing a criminal background check, or even bothering to check God's references. Rather, when God said go, Abraham simply packed up his wife Sarah and his nephew Lot and moved for some unknown land that God said he would tell Abraham was the place when they got there. Now you'll notice, I hope, that I said that Abraham packed up his wife, Sarah, and his nephew, Lot, not he packed up his sons, Isaac and Ishmael. And that's because at that point, Sarah was unable to have children. In that day and time, childlessness amounted to a curse. And it is hardly less difficult in our day and time, as Maria and I know well, in my household that is full of nephews and a niece. We love these precious children, but we still long for one of our own. But the interesting part of God's command to go was the accompanying promise. If Abraham set out as God had instructed, God promised to make of Abraham and Sarah a great nation, that is, to give them many children. And just how many children, you might ask? Well, said God to Abraham, I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth. That is, if you can count the dust particles, that's how many children you'll have. Now, periodically, Abraham would get nervous, not about the number, but about the timing. He would ask God about this, and when he did, God would send Abraham outside the tent and command him to count the number of stars in the nighttime sky. Count them, that is, if he could. So shall your descendants be, God said. It was a promise that God would make repeatedly. Only as with a lot of promises God made, the promise didn't come true, at least not right away. Not, that is, in a time frame that everyone was comfortable with. Recall that the promise of children to Abraham and to Sarah came when they were 75 and 66 years old, respectively, and Sarah's already advanced biological clock was ticking. And so, as the years passed and no child was forthcoming, understandable doubts arose. And those doubts gave way to worry. And worry set in, and worry gave way to panic, and panic turned itself into planning. For rather than continuing to wait faithfully for God, to act in God's own good time, Sarah, in conjunction and with the approval of Abraham, decided that maybe God had forgotten, or maybe God needed help. Or maybe they had overlooked something in the original memo. Whatever it was, they decided that it was time to do some old-fashioned family planning. So together, the couple decided that Abraham would father a child by Sarah's Egyptian maid, a woman named Hagar. And so, sure enough, Abraham took Hagar as a wife and had a child by her, a son that he named Ishmael. And you would think that everyone would have been happy about that arrangement. Only they weren't. For no sooner had Hagar conceived than she started treating Sarah with contempt, as lesser, as unworthy, as a woman without a future. And that only bred hatred on Sarah's part. Abraham didn't help matters when he refused to put a stop to Sarah's cruel treatment of Hagar. On one occasion, Sarah was so angry that she ordered Abraham to send Hagar and Ishmael out of the home. And that's how things stood for what seemed like an eternity. The stopgap solution proved to be no solution at all, but rather a source of conflict and rivalry and jealousy. Abraham has only just started his family, and already the family is threatening to tear itself apart. And then in Genesis 18, we hear the story of God's seemingly impossible promise that Sarah herself would conceive a child in her old age. Sarah laughed till she cried when she heard that promise, but sure enough, she did conceive, and she bore a son. And they named him Isaac, which means laughter, because the whole thing seemed pretty ridiculous to them. And then we learn today that the miracle child is now old enough to wean, and Abraham throws a party to celebrate the occasion, the sort of party that features plastic solo cups with mysterious beverages in them and multiple kegs. Not the sort of party that would be good for children with pin the tail on the donkey and cake and ice cream, but a party nonetheless. And right in the middle of the mayhem and the merriment was Ishmael, the older son, playing with his baby brother. The two were laughing together as brothers often do, sharing a fraternal bond that parents often find mysterious. It was all innocent enough. I suppose the boys probably wanted to play pin the tail on the donkey at this otherwise very adult party. But when Sarah saw them playing and laughing together, she decided she had had enough. She went to Abraham and demanded that he throw them out, both Ishmael and his meddlesome, troublesome mother. The son of that woman shall not inherit along with my son Isaac, she snapped. And the demand distressed Abraham because for all of his failures as a husband, Ishmael was his son, his firstborn son, a son entitled to inheritance and privileges and benefits. He couldn't simply cast him aside, not again, abandoning him and his mother to certain death in the desert. It's okay, God said to Abraham. Do whatever it is Sarah tells you to do. For it is through Isaac that you will have children, a people who are named for you. And as for Ishmael, I will make a nation of him as well, because he is, in fact, your son. And just as he had done before, Abraham obeyed God. He sent Hagar and Ishmael away into the desert, providing them with bread and water. But how his heart must have sunk as he watched them go, wondering whether he would ever see Ishmael again. Out there in the desert when the bread was gone and the water had run out, when it looked as though he would die, God heard Ishmael's voice and Hagar's cry. God heard the cries of this outcast and abandoned family, and God had compassion for them. God remembered his promise to make of Ishmael a great nation, and so God led Hagar to a well where she found water for the child to drink. The story, as Dr. Walter Brueggemann points out, is a story of conflict. Conflict between brothers, conflict between their mothers, even conflict within their reluctant and ambiguous father. It is but one story among countless others in the Bible that involve God's promise and the fear that it won't be fulfilled at all, much less in a time or in a way that we would want it to be fulfilled. There's the fear that God has overpromised and underdelivered, that God couldn't possibly love, much less bless, two sons. There's that competition for God's love, competition that stems from a rivalry over God's blessing, that determined effort to get what's mine at the expense of what's promised to someone else. The text, says Dr. Brueggemann, is unambiguous. Isaac is the child of promise. That much is not in doubt. Isaac is the celebrated child, the favored child, the child of blessing. But the text is equally clear, says Dr. Brueggemann, that God is well inclined toward Ishmael. The other son is not to be dismissed from the family. For reasons we may not fully understand or appreciate, God has this special commitment to Ishmael. And so today, my brothers and sisters, as we're locked in what seems to be perpetual armed conflict against dangerous and often deluded sects of Islamic fundamentalists, we have to ask the question with respect to our distant cousins. The question is, when the promise of our inheritance is threatened, when we fear that the birthright of our freedom will be taken away, when we cannot see how it is that we will live together in peace, how do we honor God's own special commitment to the sons and daughters of Ishmael? And how, as children of God's promise to us in Christ Jesus, do we live together as family? Today, we do well to remember that God is with the boy and God is with his mother too. While it is undeniably a privilege to be part of the family of promise, God has made promises regarding all of God's children. God is with them. God will care for them as God cares for us. How then will we be the wider family of God?